Welcome back to the Poor Pearl's Almanac. I'm your host, Andy, with my...
We're back, everybody.
I was trying to be very formal. You ruined it. So, Matt, what are we talking about today? We doing some really cool, interesting niche plant content?
Interestingly enough, we're on to the people content.
All right, so you got this episode, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's... I'm all over that.
Yeah. So today we are doing people content. We are talking about South Korea to the detriment of North Korea. We are talking about South Korea. I repeat. Sorry, everyone. So South Korea, we all know it as like the place where Hyundai is made, right? That's where you get your Santa Fe or Cilantro or whatever it is, Sonata.
So they tell me.
Cilantro? Yeah, whatever.
That's just a herb.
That Cilantro? Yes, I drive my Hyundai Cilantro to the store every day. But so South Korea, the country, everyone knows it exists because of American history played out overseas, right? South Korea has this really interesting narrative of being kind of like the bastion of capitalism in that part of Asia, right? It was the post-Cold War, look at this country thrive and become a major player in global economics, politics, all that good stuff. See, capitalism has succeeded. Matt, are you old enough to remember that, or is this kind of like all textbook stuff, not stuff that you lived through?
Well, no. Contrary to popular belief, I did not live through the Korean War.
But I wasn't, yes, that was exactly where I was going with that. We both have,
just in case,
obviously lived through the Korean War. No, I meant like the 90s when like South Korea became like a power, so to speak.
Okay, yeah. I mean...
90s to early 2000s.
I mean, I feel like it fell in that, like, weird gap, which was, like, if you're learning out of, like, kind of old history books, there's just, like, a 20-year gap at the end. I don't know how old your history books were in high school. So it just, like, kind of went up into, like, looking to the new millennium.
Yeah. Ours ended, I think, usually around, like... the first Bush president. That was usually where we got the cutoff. So they weren't that old, I guess, comparatively speaking. So anyways, let's do a catch up, right? So they did have this like American investment. We're going to make South Korea prove capitalism works, right? And part of that was when the Soviet Union collapsed and all these like marginal regions like that surrounded the Soviet Union had this democratization, whatever you want to call it. And this idea that like, okay, the old powers of like totalitarian corruption are falling, like these kind of like fantastic ideas that Americans had of what the rest of the world looked like, and like which was framed in some reality. But what it did is, as those shifts happened and money started flowing into these countries in the 80s into the early 90s, there was this new political power that kind of took over. And it wasn't that they were, you know, perfect or anything. They were better about like authoritarianism, discrimination, and all those fun things that we love about governments in general. They were just like slightly less unchecked, we'll say.
So slightly more terrifying.
I'd say slightly less terrifying.
Oh, okay.
But with more power. I don't know. It's a give and take here. However, despite all of the promises of capitalism saving everything, in 1997, there was what was called the foreign exchange crisis. The IMF had to bail out the South Korean government, which maybe for your lifetime, Matt, and I'm guessing many of our audience members, you might remember with Greece back in the early mid 2000s. This might ring a bell about the austerity measures that were placed on Greece that basically said you can't pay out all these pensions, you can't do this, you can't do that. And the idea of these austerity measures were just like, we're going to give you money, but we're going to control how you spend it. And the economy just got ravaged by gutting government spending. And obviously it shifted most of the burden onto the poorest people in the country, which is kind of how this whole thing happens when the IMF shows up.
Kind of how the model works.
We haven't actually talked about what this episode is about, so I should probably do that, right? So we're not talking about South Korean economic history. That wouldn't make sense for what we're doing. Today we are talking about farming communes and radical ecology or agroecology. What we're going to do is basically talk about the history of what led up to these systems so that they make sense. So we're going to do this very brief historical context, economic context, dive into kind of the early histories of some of these movements in different settings and how those are tied into like these longer lasting historical narratives that are framed in like tech and communal principles and just some really cool stuff. So to back up, in the 90s, the IMF came in to save, quote unquote, the South Korea. That was, the government was just like running out of money. And they screwed over the working class people because that's the only way to save government money. You can't raise the taxes on the rich, so that's your alternative. The reason why I'm bringing this up is this also has an ancillary effect on ecological protections. And generally speaking, like the idea of like democracy caring about things that aren't monetary, like ecology and the environment.
Oh, that little thing?
Yeah. Why would you care about that?
Well, I don't know. I feel like it's kind of like just its own little bubble. I feel like we don't need to worry about that that much. You can sort of like put that off to a side and maybe like, maybe donate to an 501c3, sort of takes care of that sort of sector.
All right, so this is the last time I'm going to do this in this episode. You might be too young to remember this. Back when I was a kid, they used to have commercials and they would write it into like cartoon episodes about why it was important to recycle. But it was like a novel concept at the time, basically. So like people, schools and stuff didn't have recycling bins until I was maybe in like middle school. So, which seems just like very strange today. I would imagine for you, it seems very strange today. And also, I guess, kind of for me too.
Yeah. I guess I could remember some of those recycling programs from like when I was small.
Yeah. It was like, hey, have you heard of this cool thing called making paper out of paper?
Yeah.
Let's show you how, you know?
Or the like one soda can or like like one beans can is like 3 hours of TV. It's like trying to make like such odd mashups of like how to represent energy.
Yeah. So anyways, this is a little off topic, but it isn't because it does speak
Wait,
to
what are we talking about?
We're talking about how the environment gets fucked when there's economic recessions, especially when the IMF gets involved.
Oh yeah.
So despite the IMF's best efforts, South Korea did end up bouncing back from their, whatever you want to call it, struggle. And by the early 2000s, there's a new interest in ecological conservation, and it wasn't particularly left or right wing. It was around this idea, there's still like a lot of belief in the neoliberal project of we can save things by being passionate democratic voters who believe that we can, and I'm going to take a quote here from an article that said, they believe they could green the state and society in a top-down manner through the ecological reform of the capitalist state, which, you know, as anyone who's ever bought a Starbucks and thought, huh, I've been buying Starbucks for a long time, and despite all these donations for my Starbucks cup, you know, when you buy the Starbucks, like 30 cents goes to the starving children, 20 cents goes to this. All those problems still exist, and I've been doing this for like 25 years now. So that thing continued to happen. Like, it didn't actually solve many of these problems. And as this became really obvious to leaders in the environmental movement, it began to like really wrestle with what a cooperative society is that cared about the world around it and the limits of both capitalism and industrialism, which are not necessarily the same thing. So what ended up happening from this is that there was an ecological alternative movement that was like a grassroots response to these failures, which advocated for community-driven ecological and democratic reforms.
Man, best few words I've ever heard put together right there.
That's what I do, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Why they pay me the big bucks.
They pay you? We're getting paid for this?
So this isn't to say that ecology and environmentalism hadn't been significant until this moment. For anyone that's familiar with a lot of Eastern Asian history, communities tend to have very close relationships with the ecology, even to this day. And this was a part of the greater narrative that we're going to kind of get into once we kind of get caught up a little bit more on this history. To frame up this environmental movement, there had been a very big environmental movement in the 1980s against industrialism because of how bad pollution was, because of quote-unquote communism or quote-unquote like, you know, the Cold War, where it was about winning instead of like making things better. A lot of that energy that went into like anti-pollution that was funneled up from radicals got absorbed into NGOs, which is fortunately something that never happens today.
Never.
These NGOs became like a part of the state center top down approach that gave a lot of lip service to environmental issues as long as they didn't significantly compromise any of those economic issues. So as long as we get everything we want, then sure, whatever, do what you got to do, clean the river, but we're not going to lose our profits. And then by the time like all this stuff happened in the late 1990s into the 2000s, it became pretty obvious that these austerity programs and these movements were not going to like drive any meaningful change.
Okay, Andy. So, hit us with it. What does drive meaningful change?
Okay, what drives meaningful change? Good drivers, that's what it is.
They started a bus program?
Actually, no, that would be cool, though. Several movements actually sprung up in South Korea to kind of address the shortcomings of these institutional movements, and they all follow similar tenets. And I'm going to talk about three that are very different in terms of location, framework, and solutions, because I think they point to like different solutions for different like utility, right? So the first of the tenets, before I get into the three different examples, the first of the tenets is centered on the core actors. And these are like pro-democracy activists and agroecological farmers that are working alongside people that may not have those like fancy titles or like power dynamics of housewives, just everyday people. So it's not like you had to be an activist to be a core actor in these movements. You could be just an everyday person that cared about whatever the issue is that they were addressing. The second is a focus on ecological balance and the intrinsic value of life. That's exactly what it sounds like. This idea of like anthropocentric views are not particularly significant. And the human connection, the face-to-face, the community-based relationship is the foundational component that can like foster trust and cooperation. And then lastly, unlike the top-down movements of the NGOs, they were specifically bottom-up. They relied on local grassroots efforts, and this included organic farming cooperatives, consumer cooperatives, and community initiatives that prioritize sustainability and self-sufficiency.
Man. Just living the dream. Okay, so hit us with this first movement.
So the first movement that it's probably the biggest movement in terms of these kind of ground up projects for ecology and environment was the Life and Peace Movement, or the Sangmyung, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong. I'm sorry, I do not speak Korean. I know that's a big surprise to everyone listening.
No way.
So its focus was on ecology rather than the environment, and to pursue new systems for how society should be structured. They centered locality and community resilience instead of attempts to overthrow capitalism. And I think that's an interesting way to address this. And I think it's something that here in the belly of the beast, we in particular should be looking towards as an example of what are the things we can actually conceptually and fundamentally do that can shift our relationship with the fact that like you're not going to take down capitalism by opening a cooperative or like mutual aid group in like New York City, right? That's not, no one cares. The only people that care are the people that are benefiting from those services, right? Or benefiting from those relationships. So I think this is of particular value for those of us here in the United States. So what happened was many of the former activists that had been involved in those NGOs turned away from that state-down power and instead found these ecological alternatives, seeking to build communities independent of state and market forces, which had been dictating their livelihoods.
Okay, so they basically like rejected the old like NGO structures and went back into these grassroots efforts throughout the country.
Yeah, like a lot of these activists came from like the Maoist politics and then kind of greenwashed, found, you know, access power, kind of worked their way into the NGO movement, or were just classic liberals that kind of carried the language of like Marxist Maoist, and then eventually kind of got burnt out by the NGO thing and said, you know what, this sucks. Also, the state power concept also is not working. So we're just going to go into these communities or find our place in these communities and try to build something where it is. You know, they realized that like the only way to address these problems were through community-driven approaches. And this is particularly interesting because like if you think about agroecology and like these alternative agriculture movements here in the United States, one of the key components that we've seen really spring up in the last decade or so is like JADAM and Korean natural farming, which we've talked about on this show, and they are explicitly political practices. I mean, if you look at the JADAM book, there's several quotes from Marx right within the book itself. So like the idea that it's not a political text or that agroecology and sustainable community-driven food systems isn't a political act is a really interesting like reframing that we get from the West, despite the fact that they are very open and clear about how their politics engage with the way they grow food.
Yeah, I feel like so much of the politics is like walled off from, well, I mean, we're talking about this like around where the election was, but like how so much of our like political life is like walled off from things that are actually political. That artificial separation there.
Yeah, that we think about it as like, oh, these are great things to do, but they're not necessarily political, or the way that we engage them as political is like philosophically, holistically political, right?
Right.
As opposed to like entrenched in actual politics, which is a very different way to engage with like, you know, I think we get caught up, especially on social media, with this like, oh, you know, growing food is political, is this radical act. I think they use the word radical a lot because it like doesn't have to align with a specific politics or politics itself. Just like a radical could mean the way you engage with society, all that stuff. But in reality, at least for this part of the world, it has a very specific political component to it. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that after these commercials. So from the early 2000s on, the evidence of these movements is clear in the rapid increase of consumer cooperative societies, alternative communities formed both in rural and urban areas, and grassroots organizations such as medical cooperative societies. So this raises a really interesting question. We're using the word cooperative a lot, and I think people traditionally think of cooperatives as worker-owned, right? And that is a component of it. So then what is a consumer cooperative society? These are member-owned organizations. Think of like a grocery store that is owned entirely by the consumers who democratically choose how they bulk order products to save money and how to keep the store open for the general population. While these have become popular in gentrified areas across urban regions of the United States, these movements can also include credit unions, housing cooperatives, and even utility cooperatives. Fundamentally, it's a collectivized way to purchase resources for a community. These movements seek to create alternatives to mainstream markets and industry, and to realize them not through declaration of politics, but through the transformation of the way people live and engage with the world around them. And this influences their values and culture and the culture at large.
Man, and it seems like a pretty effective way to do it.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten into like how scalable these movements can be and how effective they can actually be. One of the first major writings from the Korean eco-socialist movement is called the Hansalim Manifesto. And this was released in 1989, which provides an accessible framework for the eco-socialist movement. It advocated for direct transactions of organic agricultural products, consumer cooperatives, ecology-based communities, and a, in quote, return to rural communities, which was known as the Gwinnong movement. Further, the manifesto highlighted the need for local exchange trading systems and centering and recognizing the need to give attention to peace, community, movement, and life.
Okay, so can you explain how the return to rural communities isn't just the back to the land?
So
back to the land, comma, Korea.
But this time it's cool. All right, so I'm going to give you a little history on this movement, and I think it'll help contextualize where this comes from, why this was kind of their movement, right? So this manifesto was born from the Hansalim movement, which was a cooperative movement that started in the Wonju camp in 1972, following the flood of the Namangang River. This movement was built on the heels of a tradition of autonomous rural village movement in the Wonju area, which had most recently been directed around the Civilian Disaster Recovery Committee, which was led by local leaders Jang Il-sun and Jihak-sun. To rebuild, they chose to start a movement that campaigned for joint use and ownership of tools, machines, credit, and production. However, it failed. It still relied on these external inputs, machines, livestock, and ultimately capital. When this failed, instead of accepting to reintegrate into capitalist society, they chose instead to launch a cooperative movement of producers and consumers through the selling of organic agricultural products. So they had fallen back on what they had done before the flooding. So it wasn't like a mass exodus of people that were not tied to the land before, but of aggressive resistance to the forces of an industry trying to push them back into, or push them not back into, but rather for the first time into industrialized society or, you know, urban spaces.
Yeah. And I mean, talking of coping mechanisms, to start to launch a cooperative movement, it's a pretty positive one.
Yeah. And by the 1980s, they had succeeded in building credit cooperatives and agricultural cooperative associations. In 1984, the Wanju Consumer Cooperative Society was established, and it managed the sales of all organic agricultural products, opening a small cooperative in Seoul only a few years later. In 1996, the movement followed with a logistics center to organize its marketplace activities. As of 2005, there were 16 local units and 130,000 members, accumulating 93 billion won, which is 70 million US, in sales.
Man, that is some serious won flowing.
They want to get involved with it?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that might have been racist. Yeah, it is quite a bit of money and a huge scale, right? 130,000 members. That's like a small city if every single member or resident of that city was involved. Like, that's not insignificant, right?
No.
While the cooperatives themselves were a key component of the movement's capacity to direct this change, the life culture component became popular as well, and people would gather to study the community movement and life philosophy, which is what the manifesto would later be born on. And as the movement continued to evolve, it absorbed a lot of ideas that we think of today when we talk about like eco-socialism, things like bioregionalism, reviving community and local agriculture and rural spaces, and that the root of ecology itself carried as much significance to the movement as the ideology and the politics that form the manifesto. This becomes really obvious when you read its slogan, which reads, "Hanselim tries to ensure that the producers can take responsibility of the life of the consumers, and the consumers, in turn, can take responsibility for the livelihood of the producers." So the entire framework is based on this solidarity and this reliance on one another.
Man, what a beautiful flourishing of eco-socialism.
Right? Obviously, we at 130,000 members, you lose a key component of what the foundation for this movement was. And I'd mentioned those key tenets. And as the largest one that we're talking about today, the biggest challenge is that it doesn't have that face-to-face interaction, right? And as it's expanded, it's kind of lost some of that capacity to recognize the human, the life movement, right? And the non-economic imperatives that drove the movement to success. Another example takes place across the country. Jun Yong Ro, a graduate of the Pulmu School, launched what is now called the rice duck farming method in 1993. Today, it is the most common farming method for rice. It excludes the use of pesticides by releasing ducks into the paddy fields to eat the weeds and the harmful insects. Beyond rice duck farming, integrated rice and mud snail farming are also common in this region, and these were adopted around the same period. The Pulmu School offers a progressive vision of agriculture through its connection with the Anokai Association in Japan, which roughly translate into the Love Agriculture Association.
Amazing.
Right? It's perfect.
Do they have merch, do you think?
In English? Or I highly doubt it.
I just want something with Love Agriculture Association.
We could print those. We have the technology, Matt.
Mm-hmm. So true.
It's so true.
We did buy that big hat printer and still haven't used it.
We did. We've barely touched it. So The success from these farming methods led to new consumption, production, and credit organizations that helped the farmers that were doing this better control and have sovereignty over the funds that were coming in and going out of the community. And this became obvious with things like the Pulmu Agricultural Producers Green Cooperative, the Pulmu Credit Cooperative Society, and several others.
It's also so interesting that, like, at the core of all this was, like, these interesting, like, the rice duck farming method. And this, like a recentering of the ecology within the whole cooperative movement.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's really insightful that it all comes down to, like, what can the land provide? And then how do we maintain control over keeping it from flowing? You know, if you think about money as energy, flowing outside of the community, like cycling it back into that ecosystem in all these different ways. And the fact that there's like these layers of cooperatives where you farm as a cooperative with your neighbors, and then the profits go to the cooperative bank, which you own shares in. So any of the interest from any of the profits that you put into the bank flow back to the farmers. And then where the rice or duck is being sold is also owned through this agricultural producers cooperative. So everything, all of the funds, like all these organized profit centers are still funneling all their money back to the same people through different means, which is like this really beautiful and complex, like, way of thinking about what communities could look like. And even, like, you know, we talk about this idea, or, well, we don't talk about it, but people talk about this idea of like passive income, and like that's kind of like the capitalist way of like, I'm going to get out of the system by creating passive income. And in reality, this is probably the closest you could actually get to sustainable passive income, where you are a farmer and then you've got this passive income from these other streams that you are not directly associated with, but you have equity in them because it all comes down to the profitability that you make on the farm. And everyone benefits from everyone being involved.
It's also just like comparing those two, it's like a positive reinforcement rather than a negative one. Like, I'm going to escape the matrix by reinforcing the matrix.
Yeah.
And instead it's like, oh, I'm going to, like, on the principle of solidarity, like, let's make it work for all of us.
Yeah, because, like, for example, the Farmers Credit Union, they offer low rates to farmers, and those rates are lower than conventional rates, and they also provide loans to residents who otherwise wouldn't have access to conventional financial capital. And this keeps the wealth local, it keeps it circulated within the community, and it lifts up the people that need that support the most. Further, what's really particularly interesting about Pulmu is that the cooperatives don't just exist in areas for financial benefit. They use cooperatives for everything. I feel like I want to make a fucking ad for, I put that shit on everything, but it's just a cooperative for Frank's hot sauce.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be great, right? We're going to have to think about that one. So they have this thing in Pulmu called the Garden Club. It's a cooperative club for socializing and is the only drinking bar in the town of Hongdong. The profits of the club are used to buy books for the local community-owned library.
Wait, this is combining a garden and a bar in one?
I'm not sure what the garden, like, I couldn't find anything that said it was like gardening club or like garden affiliated. It was just, and what I was reading, it was called the Garden Club.
Oh, okay. I've mixed that up.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a trendy bar, but maybe that's also another idea, is community garden, but like happy hour.
Like the painting and drinking thing? But
yeah.
With plants?
Yeah, getting wrecked with agricultural tools, I think, could be good for communities.
It could be. But like, to my point, though, is that
yeah,
they were able to take this thing that's, again, traditionally we think about, like, you know, from a conservative standpoint, that like bars are bad because it prioritizes alcohol and, you know, all these things that can damage your life. But instead, they've turned it into this thing that's like, hey, if you're going to go here and drink and socialize, the profits are going back into the community for the library. And also the community owns it. And also because the community owns it, there are controls to keep people from becoming you know, alcoholics or whatever, because it's not driven by profit, where the owner of the bar just wants your money. They don't care about if your liver is going to fail, right? So you've created all these natural checks for the problems of the excesses of capital that tend to happen when people become atomized and just conduits for profitability.
Well put. Yeah, it puts the stake back in the community.
Yeah, there's some accountability. It's this idea of like place-based cooperatives, which is very different than the first example that we gave of the Hanselm movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this is specifically driven by community, and the intent isn't to scale. It isn't to create new hubs in other cities. And that's not to say that that isn't important in its own way, but rather these are two different things that can work together to address different issues within society, because we're not going to take down capitalism, but what we can do is create these really cool ways of people becoming more resilient and more connected to the landscape and the people around them. So this gives you a better example of that place-based communitarianism and this way that we can like provide good livelihoods and high food security. It fundamentally shifts the consumer and producer relations to one another, to production, to consumption, and to distribution. These aren't these isolated things anymore that kind of engage with one another, but rather they're all part of this greater network of accountability to ensure that the producers can take responsibility of the life of consumers, and the consumers in turn can take responsibility for the life of the producers. Lastly, though, even though I said it's smaller, in a sense it really isn't, because on a map, on a landscape scale, it is smaller, but even though it's still largely kept in the community, it's the community houses over 100,000 people. So it is, we're not talking about a small collectivist movement. It's just not spread across the entire country. It's not accessing massive amounts of capital.
In that way, probably like a lot more potent for the, well, I don't know if potent's the right word, but you know, a lot more impactful for the people that living and benefiting from this.
Yeah, I was trying to find some data to like back that up to see if there's any like evidence in at least in English, because obviously
Andy, this is a podcast. we don't need data.
We don't need data. We are supposed to have the most outlandish ideas ever and just like speak like they're matter of fact.
We don't need data where we're going. Speculation.
How are we ever gonna get on CNN if we don't speculate wildly?
That's what I'm saying.
About it.
That's what I'm saying. There's the money.
That, yeah. So, but I did, for some very naive reason, think I could maybe find some data showing like average household income or something like that. And I wasn't able to, but I would be really curious if anyone speaks Korean and could track that down for me. Would love to see it. Now, one of the other pieces of this is like, how does the government engage with this kind of concept of like cooperatives that are creating these like almost mini economies outside of the rest of capitalism? And the way that the government describes them is like this idea of heterarchy, which we've discussed when we talked about the Adena in the Eastern agricultural complex, and how they created temporary systems of hierarchy, which is, for people that are not familiar with heterarchy, it's a system of organization where power is distributed and no one thing has dominance. It often allows for like temporary access to power based on like specific skills or conditions. So like, a weatherman might have more to say about what we should be doing during a massive hurricane than like a plumber, right? Like they have a special skill that is specifically for this time. And once that time is over, they're no longer that important anymore.
Man, but what if I got some shit to say about a hurricane?
Ha! You're so funny.
Everybody has some shit to say about a hurricane.
This kid's got jokes. So the success of this type of model of power relies on local community development. For these cooperatives, as I was reading some of the, they actually put out some like PowerPoint slides on how they develop these cooperatives, which was really interesting to read. So what they do is they have two, in at least the one that I was reading about, they have meetings twice a month and they have no institutional framework. Everything is run by voluntary participation. There's no representatives, there's one coordinator, everything is open and transparent, and the entire cooperative relationship is based on trust.
Man, sounds like a pretty nice way to work.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds hard to believe. So to fully understand this organizational structure, it's necessary to understand communitarianism in a capitalist structure. So cooperatives, as a general rule, are organized in several ways, some of which we've covered, but the ICA definition that is most cited describes it as this. A cooperative is an autonomous association of persons united voluntarily to meet their common economic, social, and cultural needs and aspirations through a jointly owned and democratically controlled enterprise. And that is the end of the description. Now, these cooperatives can be established not only as a business survival strategy, which is something we do see when people need to share costs of overhead. So, for example, partnerships in business here in the United States are usually fundamentally cooperatives in that they're sharing some common overhead expense. But for the purpose of cooperatives, they tend to also be tools to develop solidarity and community. In other words, a profit-oriented cooperative can operate to achieve a wide range of goals rather than just simply financial returns for its members.
With a model like this, you're basically, you can leverage people's like natural ability to want to like move towards like efficiency and lever it towards like community development rather than like pure like financial return. And in that way, like prioritize, like take like the pure economic driver off of like the number one goal of this operation.
Yeah. And this is why, like, one of the things that I find really interesting as an accountant is like a lot of accounting firms are designed very much like cooperatives in some ways, in terms of like equity ownership and things like that, where my success as a director in a tax firm or an accounting firm is directly correlated to the success of the other equity owners who I didn't choose necessarily, but rather we are working with the same overhead, the same responsibility, the same liabilities. And that does force us to work together for our own selfish reasons. So like, I feel like that is like the first step in saying, okay, we've built this sense of economic solidarity with one class of the workforce. How do we make that funnel down? And then how do we create that into a greater community? And accounting might be a little bit more of a difficult one to do that in. But again, it points to like the model itself of like partnerships and equity ownership is a tool that can, or it highlights how that can be a tool to like drive deeper foundations than just economic interest. With all that said, this like explains a lot of why cooperatives pair really nicely with this like communitarianism, which I haven't defined, and it's a hell of a word. So communitarianism is fundamentally the idea that, and this is a quote from people that are much more interested in these terminologies than I am, human identities are largely shaped by different kinds of constitutive communities or social relations, and that the concept of human nature should inform our moral and political judgments, as well as policies and institutions. It's basically that the way we are human affect how we create the world around us, right?
Makes sense.
So by normalizing certain expectations, which again, cooperatives do, right? I mean, this is why the church is so effective, right? Because they normalize expectations and values. And this can shape our morals, our personal morals, and our obligation to people within our communities. Again, why do people do stuff for their church that they don't get paid for, that volunteer for the church, that wouldn't volunteer for anything else, right? Or they volunteer for things that they care about, but that's about it. But they wouldn't, the people that might volunteer for a food pantry that wouldn't volunteer if it weren't affiliated with a church, right? It normalizes those expectations and values in the context of that community. And I think that is something that we are largely missing today in a lot of ways. This is one way that we can engage with it that reaffirms our needs as people to have self-fulfilling careers and also addresses the issues that we have with actually making meaningful change, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these expectations, these values, these obligations for these cooperatives in South Korea that we're discussing, for example, also include responsibilities to ecology, to our collective history, which in their case is framed in a longer narrative of cooperative farming before Cold War, before any of imperialist powers had come to Korea, in many senses, they're reclaiming their history. And this becomes really clear with the Hongdong farming practices, that their food products are place-based in their traditional rural identity, rather, and they center traditional ecological agriculture.
Simply what a dream. What a thing for us to aim towards.
Yeah. Like I said, this lines up with this longer, greater historical narrative for this region, which is why, going back to the land is very different than some yuppie college kids in San Francisco going back to the land where their great-grandparents might have lived once, but they have no actual historical connection, and it's on colonized land, and all these other things that are very different than what we're talking about here. And unlike what we saw with the Hanselin movement, the Hongdongmyeon don't attempt to challenge capitalism by scaling up and sacrificing that intimacy from that face-to-face. They rather operate with the intent to improve their communities and recognize the limitations of their boundaries and instead try to stand as an example, as a model for the rest of the world, which I think is extremely powerful. In the same way the Zapatistas, their goal isn't to expand their reach, right? It's to say, we exist, we are here, we are proud of where we are, and we are a part of this greater context that was before us and that will continue after us. They can do this, much like the Zapatistas, by also still engaging with capital, but having full democratic cooperative control over all the money, economic components that are associated, while also recognizing the needs of the landscape itself.
And we too can aim for a shout out on InfoWars.
I wonder if we could run, oh my God, we're going to run ads on InfoWars. Donate to our Patreon so we can run ads on InfoWars.
I would really, really love that.
I'm dead ass serious.
I wonder how much it costs.
Then we're going to do bumper stickers about, we ran ads on InfoWars and all I got were these stupid bumper stickers or something along those lines. We're going to come up with something.
Okay. So if you know anyone at The Onion, shout us out.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they'll take money for advertising. That's like their thing.
So true.
Speaking of capitalism. So I know I said we're going to do three. We're already at 50 something minutes. So we're only going to do two today. But I do think this points to like this really interesting way of how do we, you know, I think here in the belly of the beast, we really struggle with like, if we can't overthrow the United States government, what are we even doing? Like, we're going to go stand on a sidewalk with...
And what can we do?
Yeah. Like, we're going to go stand on a sidewalk and, like, hand out water bottles. I'm like, that's fine. But, like, we can do more than that. And we can't be afraid to do more than that because we think it violates our values. Like, no, we have to figure out ways to, like, build our community up and, in many ways, align our interests with economic interests so that we can get people to see from our angle and to get them to buy into our vision by showing them that we can build better things. And I think that's scary, but also really, really important.
Amen.
Amen. Matt with the deep thoughts of the deep. So if you guys are curious about sources, citations, I got some pretty cool pictures of old books and stuff and early leaders of some of these movements. Go check out the Substack, agroecologies.org. As always, you can get content early on our Patreon for $2 a month and support us. You also get ad-free episodes there, which is pretty cool, right? Because we live in under capitalism and it's just unrelenting in its increases of inflation.
So give us money to escape the more capitalism.
Yeah, if we get enough money, then we can passively live by doing more capitalism. Everyone wins except for you. Sorry, sucker.
Dear listener.
Dear listener, but really, we do appreciate it. It does help us when we're recording at like 11 o'clock at night, like we are right now. Whew. Trying to squeeze it in so that it gets done and is not affecting our ability to do our regular jobs for the most part. And yeah, I'm excited. This is a new series that we're getting into, and it's going to be a lot of stuff like this. So I hope you guys are enjoying it because there's more where this came from.
So buckle up, bucko.
Buck up, bucko. Yeah, any last thoughts, Matt?
No.
Cool.
Go read some Marx out of a Judean book.
The only Marx I read,
mm-hmm.
Which is actually probably accurate.
The only Marx I read comes out of the Almanac.
Out of the Almanac. All right. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this. Go check out whatever it is that we have up on Patreon. Check out our store, poorproles.shop, or our website, poorproles.com. And we'll see you guys around.
See ya.